Part 3, Hinayana and Mahayana, the Three Vehicles. By the Hinayana is meant that form of Buddhism which prevails in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos, the literary basis of which is the text of the Pali Canon. Its popularization in the West, through the writings of several generations of Orientalists notwithstanding, the term Hinayana remains in general unacceptable to the followers of this school, many of whom nowadays prefer to describe themselves as belonging to the Theravada, or school of elders. As we saw at the conclusion of Chapter 1, the more conservative wing of the Sangha divided in the course of the century following the decisive break which took place at or in connection with the Second Council, the Council of Vaishali, into a number of schools, one of which was the Theravada. Whether the form of Buddhism now prevailing in Sri Lanka, Burma, and the rest of the so-called Theravadan domains is in fact the descendant of this ancient school is far from being as self-evident as the people of those countries believe. From the tenor of its teaching, however, we may at least infer with certainty that it is descended from one of the Hinayana schools, as the sole survivor of which there is some justification for our continuing the usage of applying to it the designation originally covering the whole group. By the Mahayana is meant the form of Buddhism flourishing in Nepal, Tibet, Mongolia, China, Japan, Korea, and parts of Central Asia. Its literary basis being the voluminous texts of the Chinese and Tibetan sacred canons, the bulk of which are translations from Sanskrit originals, in 9 cases out of 10 no longer extant. The complete Mongolian version of the Tibetan canon and the Japanese version of the Chinese canon, in all of which additional strata of indigenous materials have been deposited, are of secondary importance. Historically, the schools and sub-schools of the Mahayana, numbering in all probably nearly 100 distinct branches of the parent trunk, are the spiritual descendants of the Mahasamgikas, or Great Assemblists, representing the more progressive wing of the Sangha at the time of the Council of Vaishali. Despite the fact that certain scholars, misled by a merely intellectual criterion, have, on the grounds that there is little distinctively Mahayana in their doctrines, insisted on classifying the Mahasamgikas and their offshoots as Hinayanists, we prefer to follow the Mahayana tradition, which, applying the criteria not of doctrinal identity, but of continuity of spiritual life, has ever regarded them as Mahayanists. Which procedure is more in accordance with the principle laid down in the last section, and hence more genuinely Buddhist, the reader may decide for himself. At any rate, none can gainsay the fact that the Mahasamgikas and their immediate offshoots no longer exist as an independent body, because that small residue of distinctive doctrine which, surviving the most vigorous shakings of the scientific sieve, still remains to their credit, was taken up and developed not by any of the admittedly Hinayana schools, but exclusively by schools belonging to the Mahayana. What these schools were and what they taught, and still teach, for unlike the Hinayana schools, they have not yet fallen into the sear and yellow leaf, we shall see in Chapter 3. In the present chapter, our concern is, firstly, with the general nature of the Hinayana-Mahayana conflict. For on the intellectual level, a conflict undoubtedly it was and still is, disregarding whatever complications might have been introduced by the peculiarities of this or that individual school, whether Hinayanist or Mahayanist. Secondly, with what we may call basic Mahayana, or the tenets which are common to all Mahayana schools, in the same way that the doctrines and methods described in Chapter 1, comprising what we there term basic Buddhism, are common to all Buddhist schools without exception. While the term Mahayana means literally the great way or superior vehicle, the literal meaning of Hinayana is the small way, or inferior vehicle. From the nature of the distinction involved in this nomenclature, a number of less invidious alternatives to which occur in the Sanskrit texts, one easily infers not only that it originated with the Mahayanists, but that it was intended to characterize a difference felt to be acute. The word jnana, though in all probability never used in its later technical sense by the Buddha himself, was familiar to all schools of early Buddhism, all of which recognise the existence of three jhanas: Sravaka jhana, Pratyeka Buddha jhana, and Bodhisattva jhana, meaning the path, vehicle or career. This last perhaps being the most satisfactory English equivalent of the disciple, of the private Buddha, and of the Bodhisattva. References to these three classes of aspirants and to their respective vehicles, as in anticipation of an important parable we shall generally tender the term, occur very frequently in almost all Mahayana scriptures, commentaries and expository works. By the Sravaka, Pali Savaka, hearer, or disciple, is signified one who attains any of the four stages of holiness, up to and including arahatship, only after having heard, that is to say learned, about the transcendental path from a Buddha or from a Buddha's disciple. The Pratyekya Buddha, Pali Pachekya Buddha, on the contrary, attains arahantship in complete independence of all external supports, living not only without a teacher, but without a pupil. He makes no attempt to share with others his self-acquired knowledge of the path to nirvana. He is therefore fittingly termed an individual, private, solitary, or silent Buddha. A bodhisattva, Pali bodhisatta, is one bent on attaining supreme enlightenment, the literal meaning of the term, not merely for his own sake, but for the sake of all sentient beings. His career lasts for hundreds of thousands of births, in every one of which he prepares himself for his great achievement by the practice of the six perfections on a heroic scale. In his last human birth, he attains enlightenment in the same way as the Pratyekya Buddha, without the guidance of a teacher, but instead of enjoying the sweet but selfish rest of quiet wilds, he rises from his seat at the foot of the Bodhi tree and goes forth as the teacher of gods and men. Since the Bodhisattva jhana has for its goal the attainment of supreme Buddhahood, it is also known as the Buddha jhana or Tathagata jhana. According to the Pali scriptures, the Buddha recognised no essential difference between his own insight and that of his disciples. The only difference was the accidental one of relative priority and posteriority of attainment. References to Pratyekya Buddhahood are rare. In the eyes of the early Buddhist schools, however, the difference loomed much larger, and arhatship, Pratyekya Buddhahood, and supreme Buddhahood gradually assumed the character of three distinct and mutually independent spiritual ideals. Once they had thus been discriminated, a corresponding difference of opinion as to which of the three should be followed at once arose. The Theravadins, on the grounds that the Bodhisattva jhana was not a universally valid ideal, but only a description of the path followed by Tathagatas, whose appearance in the universe was a miraculously rare event, maintained that the Buddha had taught only the path to arahatship, and that with the exception of the infinitesimal minority bound for supreme enlightenment, all Buddhists should tread this path, and this path alone. To the Savastivadins, however, all three ideals are equally valid. Some Buddhists follow one, some another, and the difference of paths is due to the difference of temperaments. In their efforts to explain the nature of this difference of temperaments and why it should exist, the Savastivadins became entangled in a number of doctrinal difficulties, which, together with other problems of a similar kind, were inherited by the Mahayanists, who ultimately solved them by the simple expedient of adopting a point of view from which they no longer had any meaning. Incidentally, it is curious to find at least one prominent modern exponent of the Theravada form of Buddhism, not unnaturally impressed by the sublimity of the Bodhisattva ideal, preaching in the name of pure Buddhism the distinctively Sarvastivadin doctrine of the equal validity of all three ideals. The fact is significant, for it suggests that the usual Theravadin doctrine does not command the full support even of its own scriptures in Pali. Against both Theravadins and Savastivadins, the Mahayanists strenuously upheld the universal validity of the Bodhisattvayana, maintaining that every Buddhist ought to aspire to supreme Buddhahood. The path of the disciple and of the private Buddha, they contended, led to the liberation of one person only, to mere individual enlightenment, in their eyes a narrow, not to say selfish, ideal. The path of the Bodhisattva, on the contrary, though incomparably more arduous, led in the end to the emancipation of an infinite number of living beings, to universal enlightenment. It represented an ideal of unbounded altruism, obviously the highest and noblest ideal of all. To the jhanas of the disciple and the private Buddha, since they were restricted in scope, was applied the epithet hina, meaning low, small, or inferior. To that of the Bodhisattva, in scope unlimited, the epithet maha, sublime, great, or superior. Thus the terms Hinayana and Mahayana give expression to the fundamental antagonism which exists between the spiritual ideals of the two great branches of Buddhism, between the ideals, that is to say, of individual enlightenment on the one hand and universal enlightenment on the other. What was said in the last section concerning the possibility of contradictory doctrines leading to the same transcendental realization should, however, be neither lost sight of nor forgotten. Though their opponents were invariably blind to this higher third dimension of the problem, the Mahayanists, on the whole, kept it clearly and conspicuously in view, declaring in the emphatic words of the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, one of the most impressive and important of all Mahayana scriptures, "In the whole universe, there are not even two vehicles, how much less a third." This momentous doctrine of the identity on the transcendental plane of the three jhanas, the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra makes clear by means of a magnificent parallel, well known throughout the Far East. The Blessed One, seated on the Vulture Peak, in the midst of an ocean-wide assembly of bodhisattvas, gods, serpent kings, demon kings, and their followers, the arhats having walked out in disgust, is represented as addressing the elder Sariputra. "Sariputra, suppose in a certain kingdom, city or town, there is a great elder, old and worn, of boundless wealth, and possessing many fields, houses, slaves and servants. His house is spacious and large, but it has only one door, and many people dwell in it, 100, 200, or even 500 in number. Its halls and chambers are decayed and old, its wall crumbling down, the bases of its pillars rotten, the beams and roof trees toppling and dangerous. On every side, at the same moment, fire suddenly starts and the house is in conflagration. The boys of the elder, say, 10, 20, or even 30, are in the dwelling. The elder, on seeing this conflagration spring up on every side, is greatly startled and reflects thus: though I am able to get safely out of the gate of this burning house, yet my boys in the burning house are pleasurably absorbed in amusements without apprehension, knowledge, surprise, or fear. Though the fire is pressing upon them, and pain and suffering are instant, they do not mind or fear, and have no impulse to escape. Shariputra, this elder ponders thus: I am strong in my body and arms. Shall I get them out of the house by means of a flour vessel, or a bench, or a table? Again he ponders: this house has only one gate, which is moreover narrow and small. My children are young, knowing nothing as yet, and attached to their place of play, perchance they will fall into the fire and be burnt. I must speak to them on this dreadful matter, warning them that the house is burning, and that they must come out instantly lest they be burnt and injured by the fire." Having reflected thus, according to his thoughts, he calls to his children, "Come out quickly, all of you." Though their father, in his pity, lures and admonishes them with kind words, yet the children, joyfully absorbed in their play, are unwilling to believe him and have neither surprise nor fear, nor any mind to escape. Moreover, they do not know what is the fire he means, or what the house, and what he means by being lost, but only run hither and thither in play, no more than glancing at their father. Then the elder reflects thus, "This house is burning in a great conflagration. If I and my children do not get out at once, we shall certainly be burnt up by it. Let me now, by some expedient, cause my children to escape this disaster." Knowing that to which each of his children is predisposed, and all the various attractive playthings and curiosities to which their nature will joyfully respond, the father tells them, saying, "Here are rare and precious things for your amusement. If you do not come and get them, you will be sorry for it afterwards. So many goat carts, deer carts, and bullock carts are now outside the gate to play with. All of you, come quickly out of this burning house, and I will give you whatever you want." Thereupon the children, hearing of the attractive playthings mentioned by their father, and because they suit their wishes, everyone eagerly, each pushing the other and racing one against the other, comes rushing out of the burning house. Then the elder, seeing his children have safely escaped and are all in the square, sits down in the open, no longer embarrassed, but with a mind at ease and ecstatic with joy. Then each of the children says to the father, "Father, please now give us those playthings you promised us, goat carts, deer carts, and the bullock carts." Shariputra. Then the elder gives to the children equally each a great cart, lofty and spacious, adorned with all the precious things, surrounded with railed seats, hung with bells on its four sides, and covered with curtains, splendidly decorated also with various rare and precious things, draped with strings of precious stones, hung with garlands of flowers, thickly spread with beautiful mats, and supplied with rosy pillows. It is yoked with white bullocks of pure white skin, of handsome appearance, and of great muscular power, which walk with even steps and with the speed of the wind, and also has many servants and followers to guard them. Wherefore? Because this great elder is of boundless wealth, and all his various storehouses are full to overflowing, so he reflects thus, "My possessions being boundless, I must not give my children inferior small carts. All these children are my sons, who I love without partiality. Having such great carts made of the seven precious things, infinite in number, I should with equal mind bestow them on each one without discrimination. Wherefore? Because were I to give them to the whole nation, these things of mine would not run short. How much less so to my children?" Meanwhile, each of the children rides on his great cart, having received that which he had never before had and never expected to have. Every detail of this great parable, retold in the gatha or verse portion of the text, in an even more highly embellished style, is fraught with meaning, to be teased out only by patient and thoughtful study. The rich elder, as the sutra itself explains at length, is of course the Buddha. The burning house with its decayed old halls and chambers, the various realms of phenomenal existence, all transitory and on fire with greed, hatred, and delusion. The thoughtless boys, joyfully absorbed in play, are sentient beings. The promised goat carts and deer carts are the vehicle of the Pratekya Buddhas, while the magnificently adorned bullock carts, in which all the children eventually ride, are the great vehicle, the vehicle of the Bodhisattva. Though, from the point of view of method, the sutra admits the existence of three vehicles, so far as doctrine is concerned, it recognizes one only. The difference of jhanas is a device made necessary by the fact that, from the standpoint of relative truth, beings are of different dispositions. At the level of absolute truth, however, where there obtains not even a real difference of beings, there can be no question of distinction of temperaments and vehicles. Like the Satipatthana Sutra of the Pali Canon, the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra teaches that, in the words of the former, there is only one way for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for reaching the right path, for the attainment of Nibbana. This one way, Ekayana, consists, according to the Pali text, in the cultivation of mindfulness of the body, especially of the process of respiration, of feelings, whether pleasant, painful or neutral, of thoughts, whether defiled or undefiled by greed, hatred and delusion, and of dharmas, in the sense of the whole body of conceptual formulations of the teachings, such as the doctrines of the five heaps, the seven constituents of enlightenment, and the four Aryan truths. The first three bases for the development of mindfulness coincide, not only in principle, but often in detail also, with meditation, the second stage of the way. The fourth basis is plainly identical with wisdom, which is the third stage. Morality, the first of the three stages, though not explicitly mentioned in this fourfold scheme of spiritual training, obviously has been tacitly assumed as the indispensable prerequisite of all the practices mentioned. As we shall see in Chapter 4, the six perfections practiced by the Bodhisattva are an amplified version of the three stages of the way traversed by the Arhat. Not the spiritual individualist of Hinayana tradition, but the true Arhat, peer of the Buddha himself in transcendental realization, as depicted in the Master's own teaching, as handed down even in the much edited text of the Theravada Canon in Pali. The Mahayana schools taught, just as the Buddha did, that in the ultimate sense there was only one way or one vehicle to enlightenment, that all the minor paths rendered necessary by idiosyncrasies of individual temperament eventually converged into a single unique path, running without deviation, broad and straight, until it reached the city of Nirvana. Not only the parable of the three vehicles, but the whole teaching of the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, in its extant literary recension, one of the oldest documents of the Mahayana movement, must in fact be regarded as the outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual return to, or rather, for the Mahayanists at least had never lost it, a reaffirmation of the transcendental quintessence of the Dharma as taught by the Buddha, and as embodying a powerful protest against the failure of the Hinayanists to rise above the contradictions inherent in a merely intellectual approach. Without going back on the principles adumbrated in the last section, thereby in effect repudiating the whole transcendental content of the Dharma, there is no escape from the conclusion that the Mahayana, and not the Hinayana, is the main channel for the transmission of those mighty waters of which it was said that even as the waters of the ocean have only one taste, the taste of salt, so do they have only one taste, the taste of emancipation, the life-giving waters of the truth taught by the Buddha.